Using the simple word band on the Grateful Dead seems like a bit of sacrilege. The Dead were just something a bit bigger, certainly to their devoted fans. The center collapsed more than 20 years ago when Jerry Garcia, a guy so famous he got an ice cream flavor named after him, died. And that is where our next guest picks up the story of the Dead. Joel Selvin is the principal author of Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Joel Selvin has covered music for the San Francisco Chronicle since the Beatles were still together, and he's won many awards along the way. Joel's 18 other books about pop music include Summer of Love. Pamela Turley, an Atlanta writer and editor, assisted with the writing of Fare Thee Well. Joel, thanks for joining us today.
Good to be here.
We missed Jerry's 76th birthday by a day. Did you do anything special to observe?
It showed up on my Facebook feed. I guess that's what birthdays are in the 21st century.
That's right, a reminder from Facebook. So the term that came to my head after just reading the blurbs for the book was succession plan. I mean, had anybody stopped to think about what might have happened if the Grateful Dead stopped being the Grateful Dead?
You know, as you point out, the Dead have always been a unique organization. No, they never considered life beyond Garcia, even though he'd collapsed and nearly died 10 years before and hadn't exactly regained his health in the ensuing decade. Everybody remembers what he sounded like when he fell asleep on the plane coming home from the last gig at Soldier Field. Apparently, his wheezing was heard throughout the whole cabin. So they were pretty heavy into denial about this whole thing.
Well, as you point out, I mean, his decline in health was clear. Why was he still on the road?
They were making about $50 million a year at the box office. They had 60 employees. They all had gotten used to making money after many, many, many years of not making money. So everybody had families and mortgages. I don't think they gave it too much consideration. There were sort of outlier voices in the 90s going, you know, wait a minute, you know, they're booking another 60 gigs. Have they taken a look at Jerry? But those voices just weren't loud and they weren't really, you know, central to the decision-making process.
We've already talked about the Dead not being a real corporate-type band. I mean, but they did have some kind of structure and an office and all that stuff. And you describe a board meeting about 4 months after Jerry Garcia died. And it sounds like even then they weren't ready to pick a firm direction together.
No, they were so shocked and stunned by Garcia's death and the ramifications to their lives that they really just fell into inaction almost immediately. Each one of the four surviving members of the Dead thought Jerry was their best friend. They didn't think that about each other. So with Jerry out of the equation, it was really every man for himself more than all for one, one for all. All too soon. The only thing they could decide, and this is 4 months after Jerry died at that board meeting, was they weren't going to call themselves the Grateful Dead anymore. That was the only policy that they could adopt in that frame of time. Bill Kreutzmann, the drummer, couldn't even get back from Hawaii to attend the meeting. He participated over the telephone, over speakerphone. So they'd scattered to the winds already and were trying to figure out what to do to move forward in the future. They'd already let go about half their staff. They'd planned to be out on the road in September. Jerry died in August, and just right then, the money stopped coming in.
So how many people, Joel, depended on the Dead to make a living?
Well, they had like 60 employees. But, you know, that's a little village, because then there's also, you know, vendors outside those 60 employees, you know, sound companies and bus drivers and, you know, people. So a lot of people depended on, there were a lot of beaks in that trough at $50 million a year.
Wow, they truly were. So now the core four, we talked about Bill Kreutzmann, also Mickey Hart, Bob Weir, Phil Lesh. They already were doing non-Dead projects even before Jerry Garcia died, weren't they?
Although all the band has always been highly creative and self-motivated. Kreutzmann probably less so than the others, but even Kreutzmann, who when after Jerry died, he moved to Hawaii, he didn't even take a drum set, but even he ended up like playing Dead songs in bars over on Kauai.
Huh. So at any point did they grieve together? I mean, did they get together and console each other, or was it pretty much as you'd say? It sounds like all the spokes in that wheel led through Jerry, and without Jerry there, they didn't really know what to do with each other.
Right, you are spokes on a wheel hub, Jerry. Yeah, no, they didn't really even have any grounds for relationships with one another. You know, established on any kind of independent basis. And Bob Weir was on the road with a solo band that he put together called Rat Dog. It was like the third gig, and Jerry dies. And he did the gig that night. He didn't cancel the gig, played his show, then parked his band in a hotel on the East Coast and flew back to the coast, did the funeral and the memorial, and then flew back to the East Coast and continued his tour.
Wow. All right, so obviously Bob Weir kept going, and they all did in different ways, in different times, in the days after Jerry Garcia died. The history of them separately and together is covered well in Joel Selvin's book with Pamela Turley, Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. We'll come back into the conversation with Joel and learn more about these latter-day years of the Grateful Dead after Jerry when we come back to the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the Grateful Dead, which, again, I hesitate to call a band because it's just a much bigger thing than just that. But the Grateful Dead has been missing Jerry Garcia for more than two decades now, and that is the point at which Joel Selvin picks up his book on the group. It's called Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip about the days of the dead after Jerry Garcia. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Share your memories. Ask some questions of the author as we go along the way. Join in by phone at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. The idea that the band was going to go on but not call themselves the Grateful Dead anymore, was that really consensus, Joel, or just inertia?
Yeah, no kidding. I don't think there was any real consensus. I mean, Kreutzmann announced that he didn't want to tour anymore. So the idea of all of them going out was immediately off the table. Mickey Hart and Bob Weir already had plans to tour the following summer with their own bands. And Lesh, who was in very poor health from hepatitis, was super happy to be off the road and back home with his family, two young sons.
You point out later in the book that the Dead had worked for years under a rule of anonymity, which then raises the question, wow, what kinds of things did they not do because one member essentially vetoed?
Oh, I can tell you, a really good one. They didn't make an album for 6 years.
Why's that?
Phil Lesh decided that the recording studio was too clinical a place to make music. So there was a whole period of time in the late 70s, early 80s, where the only records that came from the Grateful Dead were live records. And they eventually convinced him that if they moved recording equipment into an auditorium in Marin, the Marin Civic Center, and didn't have an audience, it would be the same thing as recording live. So that's where they recorded In the Dark. And that was their, you know, million seller. It was, they'd stalled their recording career at the height of their popularity for 6 years while one guy thought it better than of recording in studios.
Well, and Phil Lesh's background in music is a bit different from the others, I gather.
Well, he was a classical music kid, trumpeter, violinist first, and trumpeter, and he only picked up the bass to play in the Grateful Dead at the suggestion of Jerry Garcia. He was involved as a student, as a college student, in some real serious avant-garde classical music studies.
And there's a section in the book, I think, where you talk about Jack Cassidy of Jefferson Airplane commenting on watching Phil Lesh learn the bass and the pleasure that he, as a fellow bass player, drew from watching that growth.
Well, Jack came to town to join the Jefferson Airplane after they were already launched and everything. But he came from Baltimore, where Baltimore, Washington, and Philly area, where he'd been in R&B bands playing electric bass, playing Fender bass. So he showed up in San Francisco pretty advanced on the instrument for the scene at the time. Most of the other guys on bass were coming at it from folk music, or Phil from classical music. So Cassidy showed up, and he was like the boss of the bass, and he watched Lesh learn the instrument over the course of months, and was really amazed at the some of the concepts the guy brought to the bass and his technical ability.
So a lot of chops, certainly, with Phil Lesh. So that explains some of his behavior about wanting to make sure that things were just right in recording. Despite the decision not to appear again as the Dead, they did appear together as soon as the year after Jerry died. What were some of the occasions that brought them
together? Oh, they did all kinds of goofy stuff. I think the first real appearance was a guest appearance with the San Francisco Symphony. Mickey, Bobby, Phil, and Vince Welnick, the keyboard player in the last round of the Grateful Dead, played in some very esoteric John Cage-composed improvisations with the Youth Orchestra. And the squawks and squeaks and strange stuff. But they sold out the Symphony Hall, and the Deadheads were in there. Smoking pot in the restroom and all that, driving the blue hairs crazy. They did a Christmas show at Phil Lesh's suggestion, where they got all their friends together, Michael Tilson Thomas of the Symphony, Paul Simon's wife, Edie Brickell, Bruce Hornsby. They got, 15, 20 people to stand on stage and sing Christmas carols to an audience of Deadhead who'd had lyrics to the carols handed out to them. So it was supposed to be like a community sing-along. It was a strange event. I remember that really well.
The book is called Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. It's the work of Joel Selvin as the principal author, with Pamela Turley's assistance. You can join the conversation as we talk to Joel about the Grateful Dead in the days after Jerry Garcia. 800-838-3760 by phone. Emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So how were fans taking this? I mean, as I think about, similar groups with large followings, I think even the Beatles don't compare, because they were together for a dozen years and split up. There's a huge history with the Dead, though, and I can just imagine that there were probably some real grumbles in the Dead fan base, particularly at a time when the internet was growing, right after Jerry Garcia died, where people were making their feelings known.
Yeah, well, the Grateful Dead fans are like you should say, more than just fans of a rock band. It really truly is a community, and they see themselves that way, which is enormously important in understanding the Grateful Dead. But the fans were in as much grief as the band. They didn't know what to do. They weren't getting any cues from the guys in the band what to do. So the following summer, when they went out on that further tour, Bobby Weir's Rat Dog and Mickey Hart's sort of Euro disco band called Mystery Box, on the show with Hot Tuna and Hornsby. But Rat Dog wouldn't play Dead songs and wouldn't have a lead guitarist. That was Bobby's approach to it. And Mickey's thing, he did one Dead song in his set, and the whole thing was synthesizer keyboards and a record by Chardet's producer. It was very cool, but it wasn't exactly what the Grateful Dead heads were looking for. So that whole tour that summer was kind of like a mass grief counseling session for everybody.
Let's talk about some of the other things that cropped up in the days after Jerry Garcia's death. The Terrapin Station Project. It's hard to describe this, but what was the vision for it?
Isn't that great?
Yeah.
Yeah, some goofy deadhead who makes his living designing theme parks all around the world, grief-stricken by Jerry's death, scribbles a few drawings and a couple plans for a Grateful Dead museum and sticks them in the mail to Grateful Dead management in San Rafael. Darn if they don't, like, look these things over and go, this is a great idea. So they bring these guys in for a meeting, and they start work on this Grateful Dead theme park. They find real estate partners. They find they buy and acquire real estate. They hire one of San Francisco's top architects who designs this fantastic edifice to hold this extraordinary museum. There's going to be condos called the Mars Hotel. I mean, it just went out of the gate. It happened to a sort of dovetail with a long-standing fantasy that the band used to engage in when they were sick of touring. They would say, well, let's buy a theater in San Francisco and make everybody come to us. And that idea had all this appeal to these guys that had done the 100,000 mile plus every year for how long. So they went a long way with that Terrapin station plan. They acquired property and never broke ground. But as the years went on and the power vacuum in the band remained, they didn't get along so well. And what the Terrapin Station, the museum project, was only one of the victims of the antagonism between the band members. But I got to tell you, when I talked to Bobby Weir about Terrapin Station, he's adamant. He says it's still a great idea.
Huh. He's sticking by his guns on that one.
He wanted a roller coaster on the roof.
The book is called Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. Joel Selvin is the principal author. He covered music for the San Francisco Chronicle since 1970, won many awards, wrote many books. You can join the conversation on The Exchange at 800-838-3760 and jx@jeffnet.org. Let's stick with the business side for a moment, because Jerry Garcia's estate was obviously going to be an issue. How big a can of worms was that?
Well, in a band where Brent Midland was the new guy for 10, 12 years, Jerry, having married Deborah Coons 18 months before his death, meant that she'd been on the scene for like 5 minutes. And she was very wary of the Grateful Dead, with good reason. I don't think they had her best interests at heart. And immediately, as soon as Jerry died, clamped down on all the payments that Jerry was making to many people. And what ensued was just massive litigation. And the key litigation was with Jerry's ex-wife, Carolyn Garcia, also known as Mountain Girl, up there, lives up there in Oregon. And Mountain Girl took Deborah to court over the agreement she had with Jerry, which occasioned the first in the history of the band airing of dirty laundry. They had had such a policy against talking about their personal issues. You know, they'd talk all night about music, but ask them, you know, what was going on with their old lady or what the other guys were doing, and they'd just go mum. So this was a hugely traumatic event inside the Grateful Dead world to have Jerry Garcia's roadie, Steve Parrish, be subpoenaed and have to testify in court. I mean, he was openly hostile about it. And in the long run, undermined Deborah's case.
So all right, so the business thing definitely got ugly. I understand that there was even some discussion of Jerry Garcia trying to decide where the guitars were going to go in his will, but they didn't belong to him, I guess. They belonged to the band?
Probably not. But the band thought they did for a while, and they had been advised that they did.
Wow.
So also with this Terrapin Station thing in mind, this museum, the guitars started to loom large in their future plans, and they made moves to contravene Jerry's bequest to the fellow who made those guitars. Doug Irwin was his name.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So all right, let's move back on.
That was another big lawsuit and an ugly incident. I mean, this is something from a band that never had a smirch on their public before, and it was one sort of ugly public brouhaha after another for a while there.
Yeah, so the sense of harmony certainly shattered there. But so was the other ones the first overt seizing of the Dead mantle by the remaining Dead members?
Yes. That was 99, and it was only three of them. It was Phil, Bobby, and Mickey. Kreutzmann still wasn't interested in coming back from Hawaii. And they brought Hornsby in, and then they had to, like, face replacing Garcia, and that was just another traumatic comedy of errors.
Well, let me ask about that particular part of it, because it seems like that's a place where any guitarist who's been around and who admires Jerry Garcia might be of two minds. One is like, wow, I get to play with the Dead, but oh my God, as Jerry Garcia's replacement, and run screaming away. I mean, were there mixed feelings like that for a lot of guitarists?
So the Grateful Dead are not like a big-time-minded corporation, as you noted. In fact, when Brent Midland, keyboardist, died, they had to be reminded not to do the gigs that weekend, and then they had to replace him. And they literally auditioned five keyboard players from Marin County. It was whoever's phone numbers they had in their phone books. They were going to give the guy a full partnership. It was $1 million a year job. But they just went with the five guys that they knew around, and they hired Vince Welnick because he could sing the high notes. They could have gotten any keyboard player in the world to audition for that job. But it's just they didn't have any heart for that kind of personnel, you know, relations. And when it came to getting a guitar player, they didn't really even talk to but anybody. Bob Weir brought in a guy named Stan Franks. Stan was a African-American reggae, jazz, and heavy metal guitarist from Berkeley. Long dreads and very cool guy, but he'd never even heard the Grateful Dead music. And they thought initially that Stan Franks was going to be the guy. He was so different. He could jam, he could get in the zone, but he didn't sound like Jerry. He just couldn't handle in the long run the enormous amount of pressure and the work of learning 100 songs in 6 weeks. And he started to, like, crumble on the scene, and instead of getting support from his bandmates, they just fired him. And now they're 6 weeks away from tour dates that have been announced, and they don't have a guitar player. So that's when they held auditions. And again, you know, you think, call Neil, call Carlos, call Knopfler, you know, I mean, who do you want? No, they called Tony Gilkison, a gal named Lauren Ellis, Mark Caron, and Steve Kimmick. Those were who auditioned for the guitar slot.
Wow. And who ended up getting it for the other ones?
So they hired Caron at the end of the auditions, and then that got to be debated, so they also brought Kimmick in too.
All right, so then I want to skip ahead because we're almost out of time here. But to the actual fare thee well events of 2015. So we're talking another 16 years down the road after the other ones hit the stage. Trey Anastasio, how much work did it take to get him into the fold? And was it kind of one of those things where it's like, well, you know, this is kind of the guy everybody seems to want.
Yeah, I think he was kind of like sort of drafted by popular consensus as that whole show was. I don't think the band wanted to play those reunion shows. I think they felt obligated to. And Trey just seemed like, you know, who the Deadheads wanted to see in that spot. He worked really hard, really hard. He hired a Manhattan studio, hired an arranger to chart everything, and he spent pretty much all of that year from January when he got the job to July when they played the gigs, June when they started playing the gigs, studying, I think, night and day. Definitely wasn't doing any other gigs. He had a few sessions with Bob Weir, and both in Marin County and in New York, and he had a couple of sessions with Phil Lesh. But by the time they all got to the last stage rehearsals the week before the first gig, I think Trey was in pretty much of a controlled panic the whole time he was there, trying to make sure that he had everything under control and knew what he was to do where. And during the actual shows, he was really challenged to step up, and he did. And just an amazing thing, as you say, you know, I'm stepping into Jerry Garcia's shoes. Wow, you just wouldn't want to do that in front of 50,000 deadheads who are going to hang on every note. But he did. So, you know, merit badge of honor to Trey Anastasio, rock and roll hero.
Absolutely. History made there. The book is called As the Tour Was, Fare Thee Well, the final chapter of the Grateful Dead's long, strange trip. There's a lot more we didn't get to. Joel Selvin, music writer for the San Francisco Chronicle since 1970, the principal author of the book. Joel, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
Great to be up there in Oregon. You know, I haven't been up since the salmon left.
Okay. Well, we hope to see you back sometime. Take it easy.
Thanks a lot.